Yeah, there are ways in which I think the unions are wanting to fan the flames of that discontent to get workers to do work that the union otherwise would see as its own prerogative, but it doesn't have the funds to actually pay staffers for. And so there is this symbiosis between the two of them. And what do you think we need to do to, break the mold really in people's conception of unions so that that tameness is gotten rid of?
It's a tough question, but again, I think it's basically going to take momentum and mobilization from below. Because what happens is, if there is enough of a significant but unified social disruption from below, like people just aren't working, even if they're not in a legal strike position or whatever, then the union brass or union bureaucracy, they know that their own leadership requires having the support of the rank and file, right? So they're going to resist that initially because they themselves don't want to be punished in the ways that they get punished when workers are uppity. So they will resist that for a while. But then eventually, I think that they will take a position of supporting it because they otherwise their leadership is completely moot. So you really do have to mobilize the workplace from below in a massive kind of hegemonic kind of way. And then when it comes to the people on the other side of the table, business or government, they too are going to resist that. But if you have enough strength and enough force, then they're going to capitulate or give a few concessions too to get you back to work. And the government, I mean, then the government for its part, like obviously it's going to try to prosecute people who step out of line and who violate the really tame system of contractual negotiations that they want to exist. But then also, like in West Virginia, eventually they're going to say, okay, look, the quickest way to quell this massive mobilization is maybe to throw the teachers a few more crumbs. And so it's a matter of having enough power, really. And that becomes crucial. And that's why, Joe, you and I have talked about this, but that's why it's really important also not to have kind of like fake mobilizations. It's very trendy nowadays to call for general strikes, and like any random activist will call for a general strike, and then they don't mobilize and they don't materialize. And frankly, you look weak if you front like you're going to do that and then don't ultimately pull it off.
Yeah, I've seen some people say of Sarah Nelson's call for a general strike that she was very careful about what she had to say and that she was not directly calling for it. She was calling for the discussion within unions of this kind of power and what we would even need to begin to do to actually realize it. And that, I think, is something that we need more than ever.
It's true. And I mean, yeah, there are things that unions can do, and there are things that unions can't do. And one thing that unions cannot do in North America is they cannot go on strike for, political objectives, basically. And they cannot join each other in strike in solidarity. There's a lot of ways in which they're constrained. And so somebody like Sarah Nelson, who is, I think, looking at leadership of the AFL-CIO eventually, was choosing her words carefully because she's aware of what unions can and cannot do, at least officially in the United States. And she's also, but she's also trying to bring a spirit of militancy back. Now you can read that sort of positively, cynically, whatever. But I recently wrote an article looking at general strikes in Europe because I was really curious. I think a lot of people in North America, they get excited about the idea of a general strike and they look at Europe and say, Europe has them all the time. Why can't we do that here? And it turns out in Europe, I don't want to make this story too long, but there are certain legal ways in which they are enabled to have that. Like in many countries in Europe, it's legal for unions to go out on strike in relation to the government in protest of some kind of policy or other. That's not the case here. On top of that, there they have multiple national union confederations. Like we have the AFL-CIO, but they'll have a socialist one and a communist one and a, Christian one and whatever. And those union confederations call for general strikes, and they have membership, and that membership will go out and mobilize, and as will the general population in response to that call. That's just not really an infrastructure that we have in North America. So the reason why it always falls flat in North America is because you don't, I mean, it's not being organized in the same way that it is in Europe. And the reason for that is because of the completely different system of unions and laws that we have here versus there.
Well, and they still have capitalism there, and they still have so many of the problems that come with it. And in the grander scheme of things, they still have the world that is burning because of the capitalist system.
Well, not just that in general, but when that was the other dimension of this story as I looked into it, is that it turns out that these general strikes in Europe are a tactic that unions started turning to when they completely, when they started getting completely decimated and weakened in the workplace. So just like in North America, they absolutely shed members, they shed union density, they ceased being able to negotiate decent wage increases and such for their workers. And that has to do with neoliberalism in the last 30 years, and it has to do with what was happening at the level of the European Union and that sort of putting some discipline on individual governments. But it was basically a story of labor's decline and labor's weakness, and that's when they turned to these general strikes, because instead of actually going into a workplace and getting the workers to walk off the job in an extended fashion, taking risks and taking a financial hit to be on strike and put that pressure on the employer, a general strike is basically a one-day protest, and they're legally enabled to do that there. And so, and where they're not, like Germany and the UK, they don't. But in other places, in Southern Europe, they can do that there. And so the union basically calls a massive one-day protest, and people walk out. And it's not that militant of a tactic, even though it looks really cool. And by the same token, the gains aren't that amazing either. So there are researchers who have studied this in a disciplined way, and they found that in 40% of cases, they won some kind of concession from the government. But that means, in practice, what that means is the government said, okay, we're going to like massively slash pensions, like Social Security. And a massive one-day strike happens, and the government says, okay, we're still going to massively slash pensions, but we won't raise the retirement age or something like that. So even what they win is very limited, because this is kind of it's a mostly theatrical tactic. And, you know, I hate to be the bearer of bad news because that's really depressing. But at the same time, I think it's really important that we have a clear picture of what is going on so that we know exactly what tactic we're talking about and how effective it is and what we should be working towards, you know, as labor militants.
Yeah, I don't get the impression that, as you've said, that the strikes themselves aren't useful, but that in a way what is being done in the name of strikes these days lacks the power because it is not happening in really the same way. It's not attacking the same material basis of the interests that we are in contest with, and that for that reason it can happen and not change anything.
Exactly. And so I think that for strikes to be an effective tactic again, they need to mobilize worker power that we have because we work. We're the ones who teach. We're the ones who, you know, serve burgers. We're the ones who make widgets, whatever. They have to mobilize that power, and they have to do so in a way that kind of operates outside of those constraints. This is and that is willing to break the law. And, you know, there are far more articulate people than me who have written about this. Joe Burns has written a couple books arguing for that position exactly. But yeah, we need to sort of basically reanimate that ability of labor to engage in massive actual disruption of workflow if we're going to get back you know, the wages and the power that we have lost over the last 40 years.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, if unions are going to change the world, they're going to have to go back to the place they were in when they were illegal, which is in this very combative but disciplined role in workers' lives.
Yeah, I would say so. And of course, we don't know exactly what that's going to look like. I don't know that it's going to look exactly like it did 100 years ago. And of course, remember that 100 years ago, there were violent skirmishes in the streets where people were regularly getting shot and killed on picket lines. That's not something that's terribly desirable to go back to. But what has to be reanimated is that ability to kind of, for workers themselves, to really mobilize from below, for sure.
Well, thanks for coming on The Old Mole again, Marianne Garneau. Check out the website that she edits, organizing.org, for lots of amazing perspectives on strategy and campaign lessons.
Thanks so much.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour.